This is the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 11th, 2018. Welcome, I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, the Is It Just Me commentary. Around the Rim, Pacific Rim news headlines, Cascadia Calling, Pacific Northwest news headlines. The Big Deal feature. Professor Stephen Mosher of Ithaca College in New York was in Vancouver for the North American Society for the Sociology of Sport convention. I talked with him about the intersection of sport, music, politics, and business, and the state of his nation. And I will award a virtual Nanaimo bar to a difference maker. But first, is it just me? Is it just me, or did nothing get solved with the November 8th debate between Premier John Horgan and Liberal leader Andrew Wilkinson? They spent half an hour on CBC and Global debating proportional representation. Horgan is campaigning for the yes side and Wilkinson for no. Horgan predictably criticized First Past the Post because the party that gets 40% of the vote can win 100% of the power. Wilkinson said the ballot is too confusing, and any change should be decided by a citizens' assembly, not the party in power. By my scorecard, the debate ended in a draw. They both missed chances for knockout blows. Horgan could have reminded Wilkinson that the Liberal Party doesn't even use First Past the Post to choose its own leader. Wilkinson could have reminded Horgan that the NDP would have lost the 1996 election if it had been held under proportional representation. Here are some of the highlights and lowlights.
They'll go to the same school, the same community hall. They'll be given a list of names, human beings all.
I'm talking about this referendum.
And they'll make a
where
selection.
They're making a mail-in ballot in the next couple of weeks.
We've had mail-in ballots on things like the harmonized sales tax.
Gentlemen,
we haven't had these multiple choice dog's breakfast abbreviations for people to choose from.
Mr. Wilkinson, thank you.
It's a simple question. This or that.
I'm not sure what you're trying to do here.
I think
can you please explain how many MLAs I'll have, how many votes I'll have, and how these votes are going to be transferred all over the province
to get your
results.
I think at this point in the evening, people are saying, if I'm just going to listen to one guy yell over top of the other guy, I'm going to go watch Wheel of Fortune. You want to maintain a system that worked in the 1800s rather than look into the 21st century. You have no confidence
just
in the people of British
Columbia. Pause for a second.
I have complete confidence
in the people who are sitting at home wondering what to do with this ballot that has these three confusing choices on it.
I think the people at home are wondering, why do you keep talking over me when you wanted me to come and explain 40% of the votes, 40% of the seats. That means people have to work together. Young people like the idea of working together. If you were woke, you'd know that pro-rap is lit.
Turn down for what?
The only thing the debate reinforced is that maybe proportional representation is a good idea after all, because it would end the duopoly that has ruled the province since the 1960s. Voters deserve more choice than the labor-backed coalition on the left and the business-backed coalition on the right. Ballots are due to Elections BC by November 30th. What do you think? Email bob@thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Rim. In the Tokyo Times, Magdalena Osumi reports, Japanese Buzzwords of the Year nominees reflect myriad influences and issues. 30 candidates for Buzzword of the Year highlight the numerous scandals that rocked Japan's amateur sports, the brutal summer of natural disasters, as well as the country's response to the worldwide Me Too movement against sexual harassment. Included on the list was Akushitsu Takuru, meaning illegal tackle, which refers to a May incident in which a Nihon University American Football Club defender made an illegal late hit on the Kwansei Gaikun University quarterback at the order of then-head coach Masato Uchida. The scandal rocked the nation's college football world. Nara Hante, or Nara Judgment, was also listed, representing the scandal involving the Japan Amateur Boxing Federation chief allegedly pressuring referees to give favorable treatment to fighters from his native Nara Prefecture. Naomi Bushi, Naomi Esk, was coined amid the growing popularity of tennis star Naomi Osaka, the first Japanese player to win a Grand Slam tournament, to refer to her soft and polite way of speaking, which contrasts with the ferocity she plays on court. Osako Hanpa Naite, Osaka's Unbelievable, was used to praise Samurai Blue striker Yuya Osako, who had a strong performance in the 2018 FIFA World Cup. Sodane, essentially a shortened form of Sodane, meaning that's right, was popularized by Japan's female curling team during the Pyeongchang Winter Olympics, which gained them fans on their way to a bronze medal finish. And ABC News Australia reports, China's AI news anchor vows to work tirelessly to keep you informed. China's state-run Xinhua news agency has released footage of its newest stars, virtual news presenters which use artificial intelligence to copy human voices and facial expressions. The pair of suit-wearing male AI news anchors, one speaking Mandarin and the other speaking English, made their debut at the World Internet Conference in China's Zhejiang province. According to the videos, the looks and features of the English-speaking anchor are based on the flesh-and-blood Xinhua presenter Zhang Zhao, while the Chinese version is modeled on fellow Xinhua presenter Chu Hao. China is aiming to become a world leader in artificial intelligence by 2030, as the country aims to remodel itself as a high-tech powerhouse and move away from cheap manufactured goods. That's Around the Rim, the non-AI version, on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines from around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Brad Schmidt reports, Oregon breaks turnout record for total ballots in a midterm election. The state's tally shows 67.8% of eligible Oregon voters returned ballots. That represents a whopping 1.87 million voters. That tally of ballots has already... 3, 2, 1. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for... 3, 2, 1. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Oregonian, Brad Schmidt reports, Oregon breaks turnout record for total ballots in a midterm election. The state's current tally shows 67.8% of eligible Oregon voters returned ballots. That represents a whopping 1.87 million voters. That tally of ballots cast has already broken records for an Oregon midterm election. The previous record from 2014 was 1.54 million. That means at least 300,000 more Oregonians voted in this election than 4 years ago. But the rate of return seems unlikely to set any records. Even though it will rise over the next few days, the turnout rate probably won't surpass the results from the past three midterm elections. 70.9% in 2014, 71.9% in 2010, and 70.8% in 2006. Oregon's vote-by-mail system, approved in 1998, makes the Beaver State something of an anomaly on Election Day. Instead of facing hours-long lines of voters at polling booths, the biggest inconvenience for many Oregonians may be to not forget placing a ballot in the mail or to return it at a designated drop box by 8 p.m. In the Seattle Times, Joseph O'Sullivan reports, Washington state voters approved new gun regulations in I-1639. Here's what the law will do. Initiative 1639 passed with more than 60% of the vote. Opponents say they will sue in an attempt to block the law. I-1639 raises the legal age to buy any semi-automatic rifle to 21 from 18. People wanting one also have to pass an enhanced background check, show proof that they have taken a firearms training course, and wait 10 business days before they can take possession of the weapon. I-1639's citizen sponsor was Paul Kramer, the father of a teenager injured in a 2016 Mukilteo house party shooting that left three others dead. The shooter in that instance was a 19-year-old who bought an AR-15 rifle about a week before the attack. The Yes campaign raised nearly $5.5 million, with much of that coming from a handful of big-dollar donors, like venture capitalist Nick Hanauer, former Microsoft CEO Steve Ballmer, and Microsoft co-founder and philanthropist Paul Allen, who died last month. Supporters of the initiative included two of King County's top law enforcement officials, Prosecutor Dan Satterberg and Sheriff Mitzi Joennecht, as well as State Attorney General Bob Ferguson. The largest opposition groups were the National Rifle Association and a pair of Bellevue-based gun rights organizations, the Second Amendment Foundation and Citizens Committee for the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. Those groups raised roughly $610,000 in cash and in-kind donations to fight the measure, campaign finance records show. In the Everett Herald, Jerry Cornfield reports, big corporations were among the winners of Tuesday's voting. Big Soda, with a cash of $20 million, the largest corporate purveyors of soft drinks, successfully sold Initiative 1634 as an anti-tax measure. They initially focused on preserving affordable groceries. They gained steam by marketing a yes vote as a stand against new taxes. However, foes of this proposition aren't without options. They can still ask lawmakers to enact a soda tax statewide. This isn't over. Big Oil. After exposing weaknesses in the construct of the carbon emission fee measure, this smartly crafted campaign pummeled Initiative 1631 into defeat with $31 million well-spent dollars. With the world watching, the outcome of this attempt to put a price on pollution, that's what supporters said, the measure was passing in only 3 of 39 counties election night. Among the losers, Governor Jay Inslee. Tackling climate change is the raison d'etre of this Democratic governor. Yet in 6 years on the job, none of his grand carbon emission reduction schemes have gained traction. He got behind Initiative 1631 in a big way, appearing in television ads and mailers. Still, voters did not reward him for the effort. This setback won't scuttle incessant murmurings of him running for president or a third term. Tuesday's result could provide fodder for those who might be opposite him down the line. That's Cascadia Calling on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. This is the Big Deal feature on the Breaker.News podcast. Further chaos in the United States last week. Midterm elections gave the Democrats control of the House, but the Republicans gained more power in the Senate. President Donald Trump sparred with CNN reporter Jim Acosta, whose press pass was pulled, sparking complaints from media organizations. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was fired, and there was another mass shooting. A dozen innocent people were killed in Thousand Oaks, California. Professor Stephen Mosher of Ithaca College in New York is a commentator on sport and popular culture and sport as political resistance. Mosher was in Vancouver for the North American Society for the Sociology of Sport convention, which looked at sport, music, and culture. Mosher presented research on how the music of John Mellencamp was used on sports TV and how it intersects with politics and business.
Well, Mellencamp has always been quite political with his music ever since he started the Farm Aid concert to help the small family farmers in being saved from the corporations, as it were, in the mid-1980s. And in 1991, CBS approached him about using his anthem, Small Town, to introduce the men's NCAA final basketball championship in a little video package. And since I happen to be starting my career and very interested in media and Mellencamp and the nexus of those two, I managed to tape it off the air using a VHS tape machine. Now everything's available on YouTube. And about 25 years later, in 2006, Mellencamp had written another anthem called Our Country that he was willing to allow Chevy to use as a multiple set of advertisements for their trucks, and his argument to having, quote, being accused of selling out was that at my age, I've lost a lot of relevance, and I think I still have something important to say, so this is better than nothing. His music video for that song played heavily in country music venues, but it was also used by NBC to open their Sunday night Football in America broadcast for 17 weeks. So what you wound up with was an anthem celebrating what John Mellencamp saw as America in 2006, selling Chevrolet trucks and selling American football, all the while selling what it meant to be distinctly American in a post 9/11 era, which led me then back to looking at the 1991 CBS package, which was made and watched by 40 million people 26 days after the end of Desert Storm. For me, that was a key moment in how these kinds of packages wound up being more and more politicized. And that's it. So it's pretty much a how over the past 25 years has politics and a certain brand of American patriotism been infused into sports television programming in the United States to the point where this hyper-patriotism is utterly unquestioned and normalized.
And it's interesting, you're looking at the heartland roots music of John Mellencamp at a time also when urban music, hip-hop music has taken over, but at the same time, because of the political environment the last couple of years, there's a lot more attention being paid to the heartland because of a lot of Trump's themes to try to cater to the industrial heartland, to try to bring back jobs, or at least yes. That's what he says. John Mellencamp isn't a Republican as far as I know, but some of that music has been co-opted by people in the Trump movement.
Yes, indeed. In fact, Mellencamp has a long history of telling politicians, particularly on the right, Reagan, Bush 1, Bush 2, and Trump, to stop using his music. He's actually had cease and desist orders thrown at these politicians. At the same time, he's allowed John Edwards and Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama to use his music, but never officially endorsed them, because, as he says, their politics is not progressive enough for him. So he considers himself a far left-wing progressive in the heartland, which, given Trump's America, is just astoundingly disconcerting and upsetting of the apple cart. So while Trump is attacking Colin Kaepernick and changing the narrative from a plea to examine social injustices in America, Trump has turned it into nothing more than what it means to be an American and you disrespecting the American flag. At the same time, Trump has no problem affixing the American flag to his MAGA hats, and sports teams still have no problem having the American flag on their uniforms, even though it's a direct violation of the American flag code. Never put the flag on any uniform other than military, police, and firefighters uniforms, and never use the American flag for advertising, which of course we all know is violated all the time. So I guess it all depends on what America you're in favor of when you're being accused of disrespecting the flag.
Your research is looking at so many different intersections. You've got the sports, you've got the art and music, you've got the politics, industry and consumerism, and then you've got the military and patriotism. Isn't this just the way everything is going in the U.S. these days?
I think we're at a very difficult time for researchers who are trying to make sense of the current events, the growth of social media and the, quote, democratization of it, so that individuals can have their own particular voice, has made a tremendous mess of everything. And it's really difficult to sort this stuff out, which what makes one of these conferences so exciting to me. In many respects, I think, because there are so many voices screaming all the time, nobody's hearing any kind of single unifying voice. So we can't even tell if a voice is coming from the left, the right, the center. It's just coming from one individual. And I'm not sure that's a good thing. At the same time, if we didn't have cell phones and the ability to video, use them as videos, we would not see police assaults on innocent people, and police officers wouldn't have been convicted. The Black Lives Movement is been co-opted by mainstream media a lot, but still, every once in a while, there are signs of hope that you can actually break through, and occasionally justice will prevail. But at this point in time, I'm not that optimistic. Maybe if we had this podcast next Wednesday morning after the election, I'd be feeling a little bit different. I will either be more hopeful, or I'll be applying for Canadian citizenship or Irish citizenship or something, because it's not the America I want to live in if that's the way it turns out.
Yeah, I was going to mention that of course, that is coming this Wednesday, the midterms, but it may change the conversation slightly, but it's not going to solve the polarization at all.
Oh, absolutely not. In fact, I think we're headed for at least another 10 or 15 years of much, much more difficult conversations, if you can even call them conversations. I think we're going to have some really traumatic experience in American life and in American culture, maybe at the level of 9/11, to snap people out of this constant screaming over each other match that we're having, because nothing is productive right now.
That was my interview with Ithaca College professor Stephen Mosher at the North American Society for the Sociology of Sport convention in Vancouver on November 4th. John Mellencamp ends his 2018 Sad Clowns and Hillbillies tour on November 14th at the Abbotsford Center in Abbotsford, BC. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to people who make a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all the new mayors and new councillors around British Columbia who were sworn into office last week. Thank you for stepping forward to help improve your communities, and may you listen to the public, answer reporters' phone calls, and fulfill the promises that you made to voters. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send me an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 11th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on November 11th in 3, 2, 1? That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for the week of November 11th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on November 11th in 1918, Germany signed the Armistice Treaty, bringing an end to World War I? It lasted 4 years, 3 months, and 2 weeks. Almost 10 million military dead and 30 million wounded, and another 8.7 million civilians dead. It was supposed to be the war to end all wars. But now you know. Send your feedback, send your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.